few months ago, a new series called Chef's Story premiered on PBS. It's hosted by Dorothy Kent Hamilton, CEO of the French Culinary Institute, and in it she talks with 27 of the nation's top chefs. That's on the TV shows, and there's also a companion book, which is published by Echo Press. Dorothy Hamilton joins me now, along with two of the chefs featured in the series, Jacques Pepin, Dean of Special Programs at the French Culinary Institute, and Dan Barber, owner and chef of Blue Hill, both in Greenwich Village and up in Westchester. And I'm very pleased to welcome you all to the show. Hello.
Thank you.
Hello.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
Dorothy, was Chef's Story conceived first as a book or as a TV show?
It was a TV show. The producers from Inside the Actors Studio came to see me about 4 years ago and said, you know, do you know anybody who would be a good host for this show? And I threw out a few names, and then I very immodestly said, you know, I think I'd be a good host
for
this show.
Well, if James Lipton can be the host of Inside the Actors Studio, the head of the Actors Studio, why can't you do this?
Exactly. And I thought, you know, I know a lot about chefs. I know so many chefs, and I grow chefs. So I think I could ask. And actually, Jacques, I threw out a story about you. Mm-hmm. I said, you know, somebody would sit down and interview Jacques Pepin, and they would say, well, you know, when did you start cooking and blah, blah, blah. I said, but I know things about Jacques. For example, the story that I think is so sweet, well, was that your father was in the French Resistance.
Right.
And that you and your brother were sent away from home. Mm-hmm. And you were sent up, and you were split because they didn't want the Nazis to come and get you and use you against your father. And so they sent you up into the villages in the mountains. And the only time you saw your brother, because you were in two separate villages, was on the Wednesdays or something when you would come into the local town to bake off the bread. And you sort of bonded over bread. I mean, food has a different meaning for you. Do you want to tell that?
Much better than me. So.
But I mean, you're so happy. I loved it because, you know, you talk to him. He's so happy-go-lucky. You think there's never been a thing in his life that caused any kind of pain, and you've got so much, and it's just who you are.
But do you think that because you know the chefs on another level, that you can get a different kind of interview, or is there something to be said for being ignorant like me and just asking those innocent questions?
I think there's something to be said on both sides. But one thing someone did say to me who's been looking at the program very closely is how much the chefs opened up to me. And I think they trust me. They know me and they trust me. And I think that was a definite inner edge.
Dan, you mentioned that you graduated from school wanting to write about food. So how did you find yourself in the kitchen?
Dorothy put me there. She did. That's true.
Yeah.
No, I was trying to earn a little bit extra money and on my way to hopefully writing about food and writing about other things. And one job after another led me eventually to want to get formal training. And that led me to Dorothy. And she convinced me to eventually open up a restaurant.
Right. He's a graduate of the French Culinary Institute.
Right. Yeah. We're glad you did.
Oh. Yeah.
Yes. But you think that because chefs think so much about food that actually would make them natural writers? Because they have to explain things to their staffs. Mm-hmm. They have to explain things to, well, when they write cookbooks. Is there some kind of a link in your mind, Dan?
I think there is. I mean, it's not an obvious one, but the more I write, the more I see the similarities. And in fact, one of them that I think would go unnoticed for someone who doesn't do either of the disciplines of cooking or writing, is that they're both very physical. And on the face of it, that sounds sort of ludicrous because writing seems so sedentary. But in fact, it takes a lot of energy and discipline physically to sit down and write, especially on deadline, in the same way that it does to cook, straight for an evening. And I'm finding the physical aspects of writing to be very challenging. And then there's also the individuality of it, that you're pretty alone in both cases. And that also, on the face of it, seems ludicrous, considering that I have a staff of 70, cooks and waiters between the two restaurants. But it can tend to be lonely when all the vectors are pointing at you, and when you're writing, and when you're at the top of the helm and chefing. That's what happens.
But that being said, I know that there are a lot of chefs with dyslexia. So,
well, we have a chef, another chef here, Jacques Pepin, right, who's written a slew of cookbooks, including two classics, La Technique and La Méthode. Mm-hmm. I want to talk to you about that in just a moment. My guests are Dorothy Hamilton, who is the host of a TV series called Chef Story, in which 27 chefs talk about what got them into the kitchen. It also has a companion book, which is published by Echo. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. The two chefs who are here are Jacques Pepin, who for many years was a working chef. Now he is a teaching chef and a TV chef. And Dan Barber, who has two restaurants called Blue Hill, one in Greenwich Village, and then the one that is also attached to a working farm up in Westchester. Just an amazing thing that, to some degree, Jacques, I'm sure you understand, because in France, there are any number of restaurants where the chef goes out to the back of the restaurant and starts pulling mm-hmm. things out of the ground, and that's what he cooks that day.
Basically, that was the secret, if you want, and the success of the great restaurant. You know, to go to any 3-star, I mean, we depend much more on the ingredient that people would think. And way too much has been said about chef, and not enough has been said about the farmer and the product, because we're really nothing without the product. I mean, my mother was an organic farmer. Of course, she didn't know she was an organic farmer. She didn't even know the name. But 60 years ago, we didn't have any chemical fertilizer or fungicide, insecticide, pesticide, you know. Everyone was, you know, organic farmer, and we are going back to it now.
Although, Dan, you say you'd like to get rid of that word organic and just substitute the word local?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I'd like to get rid of the word organic because it seems that other entities, corporations, and big agribusiness companies have co-opted the term, so you get, you know, organic to mean very little, except the farming method. And what Jacques is so eloquently describing is that organic, clean farming means a lot more than just a farming method. It means picking it fresh and local, and picking it in a community of people that support that kind of food, and people who sit around a table and taste and exult in the pleasures of good eating. And that's what organic is, from organism, you know, the whole thing, the whole gestalt. And what we've come to know now as organic for some people is a frozen chicken TV dinner that can be labeled organic.
Or something that was grown in Chile, but it was grown organically and flown here.
Right.
Is that preferable to something that was grown in a farm 25 miles away?
Yeah, I would suggest probably
the celebration of the season is very important. Mm. And that forces you, I mean, to have fresh fruit and to go to the farm and to see that, and to establish your menu according to the season. And there is a certain cycle of life, you know, that you go back to when you follow the season. I mean, always an astonishment when those radish just pop out of the garden like they do now. I had lettuce the whole weekend there from my garden. And, you know, it's exciting, and it's better. I mean,
well, every chef will tell you that, and yet we had a long period where there was very little seasonal food in all but the mm-hmm. best restaurants, and that's perhaps because it was difficult for restaurants to convince their customers that they shouldn't be eating strawberries in January, or they shouldn't be eating other ingredients that they had to eat winter vegetables in the wintertime.
Mm-hmm. That's right. When I was growing up, the most exalted restaurants were the ones where you ate in the middle of January and got those big, fat, tasteless raspberries as a raspberry tart, and that was considered high lux eating. And I'm glad that's a thing of the past.
Well, Dan, can you even talk about chickens being seasonal?
Yeah, well, I think we're on, right. I mean, I think there's a lot more to come on this subject, and one of them is meat, because we don't really talk about local production of animal husbandry, but also about the seasonality of meat. And so, you know, as an example, we raise our own chickens at Blue Hill, at Stone Barns, for the two restaurants. So we don't have chicken from about mid-November until next week when it comes on the menu. But we haven't had chicken the entire winter, most of fall and winter, because we can't raise the chickens outdoors on grass in the cold weather. So all of a sudden you start thinking about not just those raspberries and local vegetables, but about meat and about what our animals that we're eating and enjoying, what they're eating. And they can't eat anything during the winter locally, so we don't have it on the menu, and we enjoy it only at the height of the summer grass-growing season, which I bet Jacques grew up on as a kid.
Jacques, I want to go back to your past after the war. You wound up working in...
That wasn't the First World War. It was the Second World War.
But you trained at the Grand Hotel de l'Europe at the Plaza Athénée in Paris. And then you served as personal chef to any number of French presidents, including Charles de Gaulle. When did you realize that you wanted to also teach and write? Was that all part of the same process from the start?
Yes, all part of the same process. I mean, I never really had any education in France. I mean, I left home when I was 13, which was to go into apprenticeship. Not that I had to. I mean, I was doing well in school, but I wanted to do that.
When you wanted to cook?
I wanted to go. I mean, when I left home at 13, home was actually a restaurant. So I don't remember any time prior to, even prior to that time, from age 5 or 6, that I was not in a restaurant. So coming back to America, I was starting tabula rasa again, you know, and in a sense. And I did, went back to school, and one thing led to another. And yes, I start writing. I enjoyed it and got involved into this. And I have to say that television came later. And going back to the show that we did here, maybe Dorothy has found a new career, because she's very good on television. She's very charismatic. The television is, camera is very good to you.
Thank you.
You look great. It's true. You know, some people, it doesn't really, and you're very comfortable, and you know your subject, so you make people feel comfortable. And I feel that that type of book is a normal progression from what you may call culinary book, as I did, like La Méthode, La Technique, which are really book of technique, which are explained, which I would call culinary, moving to gastronomic book, which would be the writing of M.F.K. Fisher, and writing about food, and then food criticism. Those are different areas of food writing, and now people want to go behind the mask of the, you know, the mask of the chef, which you know, that they know in a restaurant, and start to know the person. And I think it's exciting.
Well, you mentioned that you had to steal the trade to learn. Yes. What did you mean by that?
Because we learn, I mean, what the student learned at the school, for example, where I am at the French Culinary Institute, in 6 months, I would never have been able to do in 3 years after I came. It costs a fortune, but we cater to them, we show, and in our modern world, people want to learn at that speed. We spend a great deal of time behind the stove, 3 years of apprenticeship, and we are not allowed to work at the stove for over a year. During that time, you did a lot of cleaning, a lot of shopping, a lot of... And the chef never answer any question. You ask him one question, he answer, and if you tell him, do that, if you were to ask why, which you wouldn't, he would say, because I just told you. So you stole the trade, and it become a kind of osmosis. You know, you work next to someone, and all of a sudden they say, you do it. And you know how to do it. You don't even know why you know how to do it. Yeah.
They say that the Americans, Westerners especially, have changed the way that musicianship is taught in the Far East, in India, for example, where you would learn to play the sitar the same way that you learned to cook.
Absolutely.
You'd be allowed to hit a couple of notes once in a while, and then after many years, you'd be allowed to do something else. And Westerners came, and they wanted to learn. They want to learn right away.
Look at the sushi.
And it changed everything.
The sushi school all over the place now, 5 years in Japan. Here, they do it in 3 months. I mean, it's what fun. You don't even cook the thing. You know what I mean? But, you know, I'm sure Dorothy can tell you that she went to France, to the school in France, who gave her the idea for the school that she created here, and it was a long program, right?
Yeah, it was a two-year program, but it was a two-year program in high school, so they had lots of vacations in France, Jacques.
But they would never have believed you could do that program.
Oh, I know. Well, our course is 6 months, and I remember André Soltner saying to me, you could never, ever, ever teach this in 6 months. Now he works at the school, you know.
Kat
he says, I just can't believe
it's
it.
It's the American way, you know, it's different.
And Kat Kerr talks about the evening you came to dine in her restaurant and then spent an hour chatting with her, giving her advice.
Yes, yeah, she was, but she's a very good chef, and I was with Robert Mondavi, who took me there one night, and I thought the food was really great, and so I sent her a letter to the Beard House, you know, for her to come and show her talent in New York, and And now she's much more famous than I've ever been, you know. So
Dan, how much of being a chef at those two restaurants is a matter of teaching people?
Inspiring people and teaching them, it's probably 90% of what I do. I mean, you know, it's and one thing about this series with Dorothy, which I think is so interesting, is that, you know, people tend to associate cooking with a lot of inspiration and beauty. And in fact, I think it's a lot more about perspiration. And so these stories come out through Dorothy's penetrating questions. Very few of them softball, by the way. She's a tough interviewer.
Dan, talk about teaching people about a carrot and how much you'd have to really pay for a real carrot in a restaurant.
Right. Well, so, you know, what we try and do at the restaurants is we teach people sounds so, didactic. I mean, it's much more about telling stories about where the food is coming from that we're putting on the menu and that we're excited about. And so we often talk about carrots because we grow a lot of carrots. And so we grow older varieties of carrots that have tons of flavor to them and are naturally just sweet and delicious. And so I've been doing experiments with these different varieties. And on one occasion, we tried to grow a carrot that was infused with almond flavor. And so we took tons and tons, pounds and pounds, hundreds of pounds of almond dust, which is the almond, literally the almond extract after pressing for the oil, for the almond oil, and that would usually be thrown away. And so I got it from this company, and we planted hundreds of pounds of it on the carrot fields and tried to infuse the carrots with almonds, and it was a complete disaster. Because the carrots never soaked up any almond flavor, but it wasn't a disaster because we were able to tell the story about what we were trying to do. And in fact, what the amazing thing was, we had this big meal in celebration of the almond carrot, which had no almond flavor. But we ended up telling the story, and so people tasted almonds because they had been involved in the process of growing this whole story, this whole narrative around growing almond carrots. And even though it was a complete failure, it was a complete success in the end because they loved the story and they felt connected to the carrot and to agriculture. And it's sort of this thing that I think, you know, Jacques was alluding to. It's kind of hardwired for that.
Psychology of food.
And
you know,
you can taste things that you otherwise wouldn't be able to taste through stories.
My guests are Dan Barber, owner and chef of the Blue Hill Restaurants in Greenwich Village and in Westchester; Jacques Pepin, who's the Dean of Special Programs at the French Culinary Institute and author of a number of books, also host of a bunch of TV shows, including the one that he co-hosted with Julia Child; and Dorothy Hamilton, who is the host of Chef Story. She is the founder of the French Culinary Institute and chairwoman emeritus for life of the American Institute of Wine and Food, recently appointed chairwoman of the board of trustees for the James Beard Foundation. The book Chef Story is published by Echo, and the television series is broadcast on PBS every week. Stay with us for more. We're back with not only Dorothy Hamilton, who is the host and also the author of a book, host of a TV series, and the author of a book called Chef Story, 27 Chefs Talk About What Got Them Into the Kitchen, published by Echo and broadcast on PBS. Also, two of the chefs featured in the series, Jacques Pepin and Dan Barber. And also, I mean, you pretty much put together an all-star lineup: Thomas Keller, Rick Bayless, David Boulay, Daniel Boulou, Anthony Bourdain, Bobby Flay, Suzanne Goyne. We can go on and on and on with this. These are all of the most famous chefs in America right now.
Oh, well, there are still some more. That's why we're hoping for season 2 and 3.
There are 54, maybe even, I can't do three times.
Oh, there's a lot. You know, if you look, there, we haven't done Mario Batali or Wolfgang Puck. There are a number of other people that, Eric Ripert. They were just... This was public television, so of course we had to do it all in 3 weeks, and there were a lot of people had scheduling conflicts, and then you couldn't fit them all in, so we're hoping there'll be another season.
Well, it seems that there are still far fewer female celebrity chefs. Do more men than women attend the French Culinary Institute?
Very interesting question. In our culinary... Across the country, there are more men in the culinary schools than women. It's about a 75-25 split. In our school, though, we have a 50-50 split. the interesting thing is in pastry schools, and in our pastry school, we have 80% women. And we actually have a website called pastryscoop.com for professionals and serious amateurs. And 75% of the people, members, are women there, too. I think women have more proclivity to pastry. It's just a very self, it's a self-split.
Mm-hmm. But for years, people blamed the French, but I just read that one of the most, the hottest chefs in Paris right now is a woman who mm-hmm. has one of these restaurants that charges 200 euros or more per person for a meal. Elaine, somebody.
There is a great deal of fallacy here in the sense that my mother at a restaurant, my two aunts at a restaurant in Valence and in Nanterre, I have two cousins female who have a restaurant in Bourg-en-Bresse now, and I have a niece in France with a restaurant next to my mother. At this point in my life, I'm still the only male who ever went into that business. And there are 23-star restaurants in the Michelin Guide in France, about 500-star restaurants, 2-star and 1-star. And those are mostly dominated with men. However, there is 138,000 restaurants in France. And a great deal of those, just like my mother, aunt, and all that, are still dominated by women. So the cuisine of the roots, you know, the real traditional, real true French cooking, it's certainly still many more women cooking than men.
And in Italy, I would say the numbers are even higher.
Yeah,
actually, in Italy, because now we have the Italian Culinary Academy,
right.
too, it's mostly the women that do the cooking in the back.
And the husbands,
are in the front, right. yeah, of the restaurant.
Well, in France, a great
but,
deal.
But, too. You know, I think there's a reason there aren't more women chefs, and I think it is because of the lifestyle. It's a very hard lifestyle mm-hmm. to really bring up a family because you're working at night, you're working on the weekends, you're working on holidays. It's a very long day. If you know, it isn't a 9-to-5. It isn't 8 hours a day. I mean, you come in the morning and you leave late at night. Now, if you have the bug, there's no other profession in the world that you can do. But if you don't, you know, if you're going to try to have a family, I think a lot of women where they start out in the profession, they don't necessarily end up having a restaurant. They do. There are plenty of other areas to work in this profession. You just don't see them in a restaurant as much as you do see a man.
Yes, because, you know, in what I do, I mean, I've done 20-some cookbook. I have done 12 television series. I used to write for the New York Times. I teach at Boston University, and I teach at the French Culinary Institute. Now, starting here, my boss is Dorothy. In the at Boston is Rebecca Alcide. The 23rd book, I've never had an editor which wasn't a female. The 11th television series, I've never had producer which were not a female. So, yes, and you look at the food editor, food critic, or many newspaper and all that.
All the magazines.
It's much more dominated by women than men.
And the women are in the test kitchens of all the magazines.
Absolutely.
Yes.
So,
yes.
I mean, there is a great deal of women in that business.
And there is a woman named Martha Stewart.
And in a position.
Martha Stewart, you have Ruth Reichel at Gourmet,
yes.
Dana Cowan at Food & Wine, Barbara Fairchild's the editor-in-chief in Bonap.
Right. And in position of power. I mean, Leslie Stalker with...
Stuart Tabori and Chang.
Yes. All of those editor-in-chief of publishing house are women.
Yeah.
Usually.
Yeah.
Now, it seems that many of the chefs who were profiled in this series grew up in the food business or were connected to a farm or the production of food. Was that true for you, Dan?
Well, Blue Hill Farm is my grandmother's farm up in the Berkshires. So I did grow up taking care of the farm and probably inculcating me in some sense of a connection between cooking and agriculture.
Dorothy, did you think that? Did you notice that? Do you think that a connection to the food business is essential to becoming a great chef?
No. Because, you know, someone like Jean-Georges Van Gerichten shocked me because his father was in the coal and heating business in Alsace, and he sent Jean-Georges to engineering school, and Jean-Georges hated it and was failing. And when he turned 16, which is a big birthday in France, he said he was shocked that his father actually took him out to a nice restaurant. They usually didn't go to nice restaurants, but he took him to the 3-star Auberge de Lille in Illhausen, and it was an eye-opener for him. He never tasted food like that. And I just
then
presumed...
Then he went to work there.
Well, he said to his father, you know, because he kept failing at engineering school, and he says, you know, Dad, what I'd really like to do is go work in a restaurant like that one we ate in when I was 16. So his father, they didn't know anybody in the industry, and his father said, well, if you're gonna do it, you might as well do it with the best. And he called up the chef, and he said, okay, I'll take him. And he did, and the rest is history.
Well, it seems that the chefs profiled in the series have gone one of several routes to get their training. They either apprenticed, went to culinary school, or devoted themselves to learning from cookbooks. Mm. Are there advantages or disadvantages of each? Mm. I mean, in your case, Jacques, would you have done it any other way than to begin as an apprentice?
I would not have done it another way because that was the only way. There was not really any school. It's another world now. And as I say, the amount of teaching and the amount of knowledge that they gain in school is much, much more than what you would get in a restaurant. It's a totally different type of world, and I think the way we teach now reflect the moment at which we are in time now, which wasn't the case. And when I was 12, 13, 14 years old, you work in a kitchen, there is a way of learning. You know, the chefs tell you, do this, do that. They don't explain. And maybe you should not explain at that age because you repeat, because this is the age. I mean, I remember I was teaching skiing, you know, at some point, weekend. That's how I met my wife over 40 years ago. And I was teaching at Hunter Mountain, and I had the group of the Catskill, I don't know, middle school or whatever those kids were, 9, 10, 11, 12 years old. And I used to take them up the mountain. I said, okay, follow me, and we go down. It would have been useless to try to explain them the full line and the position of your edge or whatever. They wouldn't even have listened to me. Now, it's totally different if you teach skiing to someone who is 25, 30 years old. Likewise, in cooking, they want to know the why do you do it this way, the reason, and so forth. So it's a different way of teaching that we do now.
But it's interesting that you taught skiing because Marcus Samuelson and Bobby Flay talk about a certain athleticism necessary for cooking. Is that something that just they have noticed, or do all people get into this business have to be athletic?
We all do. I mean, there is a great deal of physical exertion. And as Dorothy mentioned before, unless you really have the bug and love it, don't go in for anything else to become famous as now the chef who used to be at the bottom of the social scale are now a genius. We have changed. And the point is that if you go in that business for that reason, you're likely to have very severe disappointment. But if you go there for the right reason, that is, if you really get gratified by it, if you love it too, then you will enjoy it whether you become famous or not, but you will still get varicose veins by the time you're 40 years old and work 16 hours
a day. Is that changing now with all these chefs now no longer in their kitchens, but running off to Las Vegas to their restaurant,
you know what,
there, and then going to Singapore.
Still are in the kitchen,
I think a lot of them are still in the kitchen. You know, as Bobby Flay says, the great thing with cable is they shoot a little and they show it a lot. And he said, you know, I do all of my TV probably in 3 to 6 weeks a year, and all the rest of the time I'm in my kitchens, you know, in my, and he said, I would miss the kitchen. I'm a chef. I love to cook. I don't think the chefs are outside the kitchen as much as you think they are, because you see it. I mean, Chef Story is 26-part series. We did it all in 3 weeks.
Exactly.
You know?
And I was last week, I was in Los Angeles doing a tour for my book, and I was at Cut, a new restaurant of Wolfgang Puck in the Regent Beverly Wilshire. I thought it was extraordinary to start with, but Wolf was there in the kitchen and walking around the table and so forth. So, yes, chefs
do. He was there because you were there, Jacques.
No, chefs love to cook, and they are in the kitchen. That's the place where you feel the best. I mean, it would be for me.
How often are you in your kitchens, Dan?
Oh, God, I live.
I know.
You're mostly in the kitchen.
I'm worried about me, too.
From the barn to the kitchen.
Well, but we also get this odd impression of what a chef's life is like when we watch shows like Iron Chef. Do they give people a false impression, do you think?
Well, there is a certain amount of competition in the kitchen. There is the excitement of this. I think the people who are doing Iron Chef are usually quite good and do their thing. So at least they are cooking. There is other show on television where there is not much cooking going on. At least there is a great deal of cooking going on. Hmm.
In talking about television, Dan, Gordon Ramsay is routinely seen dressing down his staff, screaming in the kitchen, calling people idiots. I can't imagine you doing that. Is that necessary?
Oh, yes. Leonard. You only know me in these moments of lucidity on your radio. You know, I lost my temper last night, and I was thinking about Gordon Ramsay. And I thought that there's a lot of testosterone around what he does and a lot of huff and bluff and all the rest. And I not something that I agree with, and I don't think you need to run a kitchen that way, and I think Jacques would agree with that heartedly.
Yeah.
But there's a time and a place for speaking directly and in a raised voice, and I tend to do that more and more. I think I'm getting more tired. I don't know what it is, but I'm losing my patience. But it tends to be effective, and I don't know that on the level that Gordon Ramsay seems to do it or advertise it is worthwhile or something that I'd want to emulate. But there is a time and a place for it, and it can be very effective. So unfortunately, that's often how chefs speak in the intensity of the environment of a top kitchen.
What people don't seem to know enough about is that chefs have been incredibly generous. They're always giving, they're having special dinners, and they participate in all these charitable events. And I understand one of the reasons that you couldn't be here and or in your restaurant in Westchester is that you're participating tonight in a benefit dinner to mark National Hunger Awareness Day and
That's
raise
right.
funds for the Food Bank of
With
New
York.
With
two other great chefs, Gabrielle from The Modern and Cyril from his restaurant, Fleur de Sel. So, yes, I also have a warm heart, I think.
I hope so, because next week we're doing our scholarship fundraiser and we're auctioning off the chefs for a date.
Yeah.
So you're one of them. Yeah. I hope you have a warm heart.
Meanwhile, if people want to participate, they can call 212-539-1776 or visit www.bluehillfarm.com. It starts at 6:30 tonight. And Jacques, I know you do all of these things as
yes,
well.
Yes, the chefs are extremely generous. And what's going on now, a lot of things are filtered through food to raise money. When you talk about cystic fibrosis or AIDS or cancer or battered woman and you name it, and you know, it's pretty dry. But if you filter it through 20 chefs cooking and wine being supplied and all that, then people will pay $300-$400 to come. But
and
the
also,
chef has a lot of requirements.
And chefs really are in the giving business. And so perhaps that's why they do this. I want to thank you so much, all of you. Dan, Barbara, good luck tonight. Jacques Pepin, Dean of Special Programs at the French Culinary Institute. Dorothy Hamilton, Chef Story on PBS and now in Echo Books. Thank you all.
Thank you.
On tomorrow's show, a look at the estimated 250,000 mentally ill Americans in prison. And then the life of philanthropist and society figure Brooke Astor. Plus, lots about music. First, from a voodoo priest who performs ceremonies in New York. Also, Alan Bergman finally singing his own hit songs. And then Michelle Phillips of Mamas and Papas fame and producer Lou Adler remember the Monterey Pop Festival of 1967. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Sarah English, Brenda Farrell, and Blakeney Schick. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Angie Sheldon, Brad Ludlow, and Lorianne Kraszewski. Debbie Daughtry was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. We'll see you tomorrow.